Welcome back to Plastic Surgery Decoded, the podcast where we demystify plastic surgery and provide a foundation for understanding it, whether you're actually considering a procedure or you're just curious. As always, I'm your host, Dr. Regina Newhan, and in this season number 4, you'll find a new approach, including interviews and covering a wide variety of subjects. But after you listen to this episode, I encourage you to go back and really explore the previous seasons, as they are full of valuable information. You get to pick and choose what to learn about next. Season 1 covers common aesthetic or cosmetic surgery topics and skincare, while Season 2 explains reconstructive surgery topics. Then Season 3 goes over general questions about plastic surgery. Remember that this podcast reflects my experience and opinion, as well as those of any guest interviewed. It is not intended to provide medical advice, nor is it a substitute for a formal consultation with your physician. So stay tuned for this interesting journey we'll take together in the ever-expanding world of plastic surgery. Let's go! Let's face it, for many women, the breast is more than just a functional body part. Their breast appearance may actually affect how they view themselves. And it can have a huge impact on psychological or social aspects of their lives. So our topic in this episode is rejuvenation of the breast and the plethora of options to do so. Rejuvenation means making improvements or restoring beneficial qualities. Well, what do we mean by breast rejuvenation? Well, it's making improvements after life changes from things like pregnancy, aging, injury, or even disease. The specific goals could be to adjust volume, either enhancing or reducing or restoring, or to adjust shape or position on the chest wall, even to adjust symmetry. Given that, what are the procedures, or what I'll call tools, that a plastic surgeon can use to help accomplish these goals? That's our question of the day. We have Dr. Richard Binet in conversation today so that we can get some answers to this question. Here we go. Well, today we have Dr. Richard Binet, who is a plastic surgeon in private practice with Monarch Plastic Surgery in Leawood, Kansas. Welcome, Dr. Binet.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah, and you and I actually know each other. We were practice partners back in the day, and so I'm so happy to have you here to talk about our subject, which is very interesting. It's options for breast rejuvenation, and there are just so many. But first, let me ask you, what kind of practice do you have? What's the range or type of cases that you do?
Well, I have a pretty general plastic surgery practice at this point. I do still a fair amount of reconstructive procedures, kind of probably primarily based in hand surgery. Mm-hmm. And over time, I've done less and less of that and moved more and more towards, some aesthetic procedures. And I really enjoy body aesthetic procedures probably as much as anything, mm-hmm. breast surgery, abdominoplasties, and so on.
Yeah, that's great.
So. Kind of a general practice of all that kind of thing.
Did your practice variety change during or after COVID?
I think COVID was definitely one of the things that helped spur the change. It had been something I'd been interested in doing kind of all of the time. Mm-hmm. And I think the greater influx of patients into the aesthetic surgery realm kind of gave an opportunity to get a little more known for that kind of thing. And so that kind of helped with the whole transition into that.
Yeah, interesting. Well, as for our topic today, everybody probably wants or needs a little something different. So the term breast rejuvenation could mean many things, but would you just give us a little breakdown of what type of changes can be made, maybe the basic categories?
Well, I think they probably would include breast augmentation. There's always breast reduction is another thing that's pretty common. Breast lift is sort of modified breast reduction where you're doing primarily skin excision and elevation of the breast. I think those are probably the main things that people do for rejuvenation purposes.
Yeah, so you're talking about changes in volume, whether you're increasing or reducing, and you're talking about shape and position on the chest wall. All those things can be rejuvenating.
Exactly.
Well, I'm curious which type of procedures that you've just talked about tend to be more commonly requested, do you think, at least in your practice?
Wow, I probably have a few more people requesting reduction than I do anything else.
They have just have too much, huh?
Yep, just a little more than they want or need, causing
Yeah.
You know, problems with back and neck pain and things like that. But you know, I think mastopexy, which has probably been a thing that wasn't the most common of the three in the past, is becoming a little more common these days.
The breast lift.
Yeah, the breast lift. And I think probably, you know, this sort of trend with all kinds of methodologies to achieve weight loss have really had the idea that they would want something to help reposition their breast and remove some skin and get things a little tighter just comes up a little more frequently than probably it once did.
Yeah, that's a great point, actually. I hadn't thought of that. Tell us, are most of your breast rejuvenating procedures done for women who have undergone changes in life, such as with weight change, like you mentioned, or with age or childbearing? Or are you seeing problems that predate those life changes?
I think those kind of changes are probably the impetus for a lot of the surgeries. Probably the great majority come from those kind of things. Breast augmentation is probably still a little more likely in a younger female who is in the maybe their 20s or 30s, who is just looking for a little bit more volume inside their clothes and maybe a confidence boost as well. So that patient probably have come to the age or part of their life when they decide that this is the time to do something. Whereas childbirth and age are definitely factors, along with the weight loss that we talked about, in pushing people toward the decision that they want to do something different to try to change the shape or size of their breast or position of their breast.
So you really get all comers. You get all different types of people who are coming for some type of breast rejuvenation, whatever it may be.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's across the board reasons why people are coming.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about augmentation, breast augmentation or breast enlargement. What are the options for accomplishing that, and how do you and the patient choose what method you will do to accomplish that goal?
Well, probably the most common methodology for breast enlargement is to have some type of implant placed. And for the most part, there are a few choices to make in the matter. We have choices about the type of implant we might choose and whether we are going to position the implant in a location on their chest, either underneath their breast or underneath both their breast and their pectoralis muscle. And so we usually just talk with the patient as well as examine to see what their anatomy is like to try to determine which is the best fit for them. A lot of times, people who have a little more breast volume to start with might end up with an implant that sits on top of their muscle, where someone who starts a little smaller may end up with a augmentation that is termed a submuscular augmentation, in which we put the implant both under their muscle and under their breast.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, most of the time these days, people are choosing silicone implants. Saline is an option too. Mm-hmm. I would say it's probably at least a 9-to-1 ratio of people choosing silicone versus saline, but it is still out there as an option for those who, despite all the advances in implants, might still feel a little unsafe about silicone.
For those who aren't familiar with the implants, what do silicone implants feel like compared to saline implants?
Well, silicone implants are made from a silicone gel type material. And so when you hold one in your hand or when you try to squish a silicone implant, it tends to feel a little more like real tissue might feel, as opposed to something that is a saline implant, which can feel a little bit like it's a water balloon.
A little less natural feeling.
A little less natural feeling, exactly.
Yeah. And then in terms of safety, you know, there's been so much concern and question and studying about this. What is your general feeling about silicone implants at this point?
I think silicone implants are by and large safe. And I think the other thing is that there have been increasing attempts to increase their safety. And the idea that silicone implants are becoming a little bit more what we call cohesive. In other words, the gel inside the implant is being cross-linked a little bit more in order to try to make the silicone a little more stable. That way, if there is any problem with an implant that might leak or sometimes an implant can break, and we call that a rupture.
Mm-hmm.
In the newer implants, that tends to make the implant not have the silicone that can sort of run out or fill up the space, but it stays, and it's often termed a gummy bear.
Right.
It tends to maybe bulge or fracture as opposed to something that would actually spill out and be more easily spread around.
Yeah. Well, in breast augmentation, what other option is there if you don't use an implant?
Well, there are times when people have chosen to inject fat and do a fat transfer by liposuctioning fat and then purifying it and running it through a centrifuge to try to make it more easily injectable and try to augment volume by injecting fat into the parenchyma of the breast and see if it can gain some volume doing that.
So kind of recycling, you know, get rid of a little fat from here and add it to the breast area. That seems pretty green. But is that, as we like to say, a one and done procedure, or might that have to be repeated? Or usually with an implant, you put the implant in and that's it, although they may need a revision later down the road. But with fat, what do you find in terms of whether or not a one setting operation is enough versus maybe needing to do something further?
Well, one of the deals that happens when you try to inject fat is that we need to rely on the fact that the patient's body will grow some blood vessels into the fat that gets injected. And because sometimes the fat doesn't become completely revascularized by the patient's body, it will be absorbed and lost.
Yes.
So therefore, you just can't do a liposuction and get a bunch of fat and sort of just inject it and try to make somebody have an augmentation based on that, because they may not revascularize the fat. And we need it to be nice and smooth so they don't develop areas of firmness or hardness just because the fat that we injected didn't actually get revascularized and either got absorbed or, even worse, didn't survive within the breast and became hard or firm.
Yeah.
So we often are doing that kind of thing in small stages to try to get and achieve a volume that someone would want.
Yeah.
The reality is it probably is a little more difficult to achieve because an implant can just do it in one step.
Yeah, especially if you are looking for a larger size, I would imagine.
So. Correct.
Well, as we're talking about those options for breast enlargement or breast augmentation, how extensive are the procedures and how lengthy might the recovery be?
So the operations usually take an hour to an hour and a half to do, and people do usually have a general anesthetic for that. They have some recovery period afterwards that's probably a little more based on whether you're putting this implant underneath their muscle or just on top of their muscle.
Sure.
Anytime we are doing surgery and start lifting up or cutting muscles at all, it tends to hurt a little bit more. And so the recovery from that's just a little bit longer than one that's placed on top of the muscle.
Mm-hmm.
But still, generally, people are back doing the majority of things that they want to do, you know, within a week or two.
Mm-hmm.
And we do keep them from doing vigorous exercise or other things that might break their incision apart or make them bleed or something.
Sure.
That would cause a harm or risk. So with those sort of safety concerns taken care of, then people do recover from that pretty quickly.
Yeah. Well, very good. Now, is there a difference in downtime between patients who have implants and those who have augmentation without an implant, such as with fat grafting?
No, I think they're probably very similar. When you're going to use a fat graft, you're going to have a secondary site that you got to heal because you got to steal the fat from somewhere.
That's right. So two areas.
Might be a little sore from that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I would think that the recovery time is pretty much very similar.
Got it. Well, let's shift gears a little bit. We're still talking about changing breast volume, but instead of enlarging the breasts, what about breast reduction? You know, I did have a previous episode on this podcast about that topic specifically, but briefly, who's a candidate and how is the procedure done?
Almost anybody can be a candidate if they have large enough breasts that they would, you know, benefit from a reduction in size. A lot of times people are hopeful that they might get their breast reduction procedure covered by their insurance company, which in that case is probably going to be a little dependent upon how much tissue they actually have removed. The insurance company will have some parameters about how much tissue needs to be removed in order to qualify for a breast reduction procedure. But generally, it's a procedure where we are removing a significant portion of the breast, and each person is going to be a little bit unique in how much that's going to be. Also, the procedure is done in a way that we keep the person's nipple and areola attached to their breast and elevate that on their breast. And so therefore, they tend to get an incision around their areola, another incision that joins the bottom part of their areola to the crease beneath their breast, and then usually an incision that goes in the crease. Sometimes we refer to that as an anchor-shaped incision or an upside-down T. And of course, the idea is that we're going to try to reduce their symptoms of back and neck pain or just be able to fit into clothing better as well.
Yeah, good point.
From a reduction in the volume that they have in their breast.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be a huge amount that's removed to make some nice changes for somebody.
Correct.
And, you know, the incisions that you're describing are longer than the incisions for breast augmentation. So does that affect the length of time for the procedure and the recovery, or not really?
It does. It takes a little bit longer time frame to do a breast reduction surgery than it does to do a breast augmentation surgery. We usually think of about 2 to 2.5 hours for a breast reduction surgery. The recovery is probably not that much longer, despite the fact that they have more incisions, because we're still worried about the same types of things being bleeding or wound healing. And we, like a breast augmentation, usually try to limit people's activity afterwards and don't allow them to do vigorous exercise for probably about a month.
All right. Well, let's shift gears a little bit again. And instead of talking about volume, let's talk about shape of the breast or position on the chest wall, because those can be problematic for some people. So how would we rejuvenate that?
So when we look at a breast to try to determine what's going on or how do we describe the anatomic features, sometimes we use a word that's called ptosis, P-T-O-S-I-S. Ptosis is the word for sagging of the breast. People can have some symptoms of feeling a heaviness in their breast just because they have skin and a laxity of their skin that allows the weight of their breast to really feel like it's pulling on them. And we sort of describe or talk about breast ptosis in a couple different ways. One is to assess the position of the nipple and areola sort of relative to the patient's body. And the location on their body that we compare it to is how it is in relationship to their inframammary fold, the crease underneath. And so when the nipple and areola fall below the crease underneath, people start to develop a type of sagging that we refer to as ptosis. And so the other thing is that the entire breast volume can fall below there too. And so when we do surgery to try to improve ptosis, we generally are taking skin away from the outside of the breast and then creating a space underneath the breast that's more superior on the chest and taking the breast volume that's present and pushing it up so that it sits higher on the chest wall. And then we remove skin so that there's not enough laxity for that same breast volume to fall back down again. Mm-hmm. And like when we do a breast reduction surgery, we were repositioning the nipple and areola to a spot that's up higher on the breast as well. And we do that in a way that we keep it attached to the breast itself and pull the skin over the top. And really, we cover up everything at first. And then in order to be able to visualize the nipple and areola again, we cut out a circle over the top of it, like you're cutting out a window so that you could look beneath it and find the nipple and areola and then bring that up to the top.
Yeah.
So that you can really see it again. So it looks like we took it off and put it back on, but we really did not do it that way.
Yeah. And how do you decide who needs that procedure versus maybe an implant to fill out the skin envelope, I like to call it? And when you're doing a mastopexy or a breast lift, how do you decide where the right position on the chest wall is? Is it different on different people?
It probably is a little different on each person, depending upon what their body style is. But in general, we still like to try to aim so that we are positioning the height of the patient's nipple and areola to be about the same as the vertical height where the crease or inframammary fold is behind their breast. So it's kind of our guideline. When we do a procedure like this, the first thing we do when we're making our surgical plan is identify the spot where the nipple is going to turn out when we're finished, and then plan everything else after that. Mm-hmm. So the first thing is to identify the inframammary fold and then project to the front or the skin side of the breast and then begin your pattern making from that. So it's going to be a little different for each person, but that's in general what we're aiming for. Mm-hmm. And then we would like, if we can get it that way, to keep the breast above the inframammary fold if at all possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then how are you sometimes deciding whether someone needs an implant or just needs a breast lift?
So sometimes, despite the fact that we can make the skin quite a bit tighter, there's still enough laxity
or looseness
that the patient would benefit from trying to, as you kind of said before, fill up the amount of skin envelope that's there to make it a little more full. And in those cases, adding an implant to a breast lift can make a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. A lot of times the situation happens in reverse as well. In other words, someone will come and ask about a breast augmentation, and then when you examine them, you determine that, wow, you could use a little bit of breast volume to get what you would like, but you also have a lot of skin left over here, and maybe we have to add the mastopexy or breast lift to the augmentation procedure.
Yeah.
That probably happens more frequently than the other way around.
Yeah, to try to get rid of that extra skin.
Right, because otherwise they'll get that volume sitting in a spot that may not be directly underneath their breast. And so therefore,
great point.
Best way to get them together is to put the lift on top of the implant.
Yeah. So how often do you think you're doing a combination of these procedures then, whether it's, you know, augmentation with an implant plus a breast lift or some other type of combination?
Well, breast augmentation alone without a lift is probably still more common than combining breast augmentation with a lift, but it probably happens, I'm going to say 20 or 30% of the time that people come and we determine that it would be best if they had a breast lift in addition to their augmentation. Mm-hmm. And I think that weight loss thing kind of enters the picture again.
Yes.
With people presenting with the complaint that, well, I'm glad that I'm healthier than I was when I was a little heavier.
Yeah.
They have a loss of volume of breast as well, and subsequently also have some extra skin.
Mm-hmm. Now, as we're thinking about combinations of procedures, you know, sometimes we encounter patients who were either born with or have developed some degree of asymmetry. So the breast shape and size and position may be different one side than the other. So have you had cases like that, and how do you approach that?
Yes, I have. So a lot of times it's a matter of just then individually applying the things that we've kind of been talking about to each breast individually. There can be situations in which someone needs only an implant on one side, and on the other side they might get an implant and a lift. Mm-hmm. There are times when they could get an implant on one side and a reduction on the opposite side in order to achieve a little bit better symmetry. There's almost every combination out there that you could probably imagine.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, just tailoring that to the individual needs of each person is how we try to approach the problem.
Yeah, that's so nice. Well, you know, this other thing that's interesting these days, a lot of women are interested in having their implants removed. They've had their implants for quite some time. It's been part of their lives. And whether there are concerns about health issues or they're just uncomfortable, they don't feel like they need them anymore, What do you do in those situations to try to rejuvenate a breast? Because if you just take it out, you're going to have kind of a collapsed sack of skin, I hate to say, but that's probably what it could be. So how do you approach that?
Yeah, that situation does come up. So a couple issues there. You know, sometimes when people have their implants out or have had some issues with something that's known as a capsular contracture, which is a common phenomenon that happens after people have had some implants.
Kind of a hardening of scar tissue inside, yeah.
Correct, a lining around the implant that we often will remove when we take out the implant so that we can try to eliminate the firmness and the tightness that someone might be feeling that could be causing some of their discomfort. And then, as you said, they sort of have a deflation effect that happens because they had this implant that was creating the volume that they had. And so it's that situation where frequently a breast lift or mastopexy comes into play. An occasional person may choose a smaller implant, but as you said, sometimes people are just, I'm done with this.
Yeah.
And in order to make it so that they can manage the amount of skin that they've sort of recruited over time to cover the implant they had, we end up doing a breast lift in which we excise some of that skin and then try to reposition and keep the remaining breast tissue up as high as we can.
Yeah, so it's a little smaller, but it's better shape and better position.
Correct, a lot more manageable that way too.
Absolutely. We've covered a wide variety of types of breast rejuvenation, but I think people will probably wonder how long these procedures last. Are revisions or repeat surgeries expected later down the road?
Well, so it's a common thing to say that implants are not a lifetime device. And there are still plenty of people out there who have had implants for many, many years without any problems and never have anything done other than placement of the implant in the first place. Despite that, there are some problems when people do develop some scar tissue or a capsular contracture around their implant, and they may need or want some type of revision down the road in order to try to make things a little softer than they have gotten to be over time, or maybe they don't like the size that they've chosen in the beginning and they change something about their life or their position in life is different now and they want to change that. So occasionally people do have subsequent surgeries after particularly augmentation at some point down the road. Breast lift surgery can occasionally benefit from some revisions down the road, but I don't think frequently that happens. And breast reduction is also another surgery, which is not a common thing that people repeat, but it's not unheard of that people who have had one reduction at one point in time change volume or get a little bigger over time and end up having a second breast reduction. It's pretty uncommon, but not unheard of at all.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it probably depends on the quality and type of skin that people have and how much stretch there is and, you know, some of those things. I would always tell patients, with your procedure, we can't stop the aging clock. We are just resetting it. So,
that's a great way to put it.
Yeah, sometimes you just don't have control over that. You just do the best you can. Are there risks with breast rejuvenation procedures in general? Certainly there are risks with any surgery, but specifically, I'm asking about sensation of the breast or ability to breastfeed or even difficulty with future mammograms.
Well, I think all of those things have some role in the whole entire discussion. You know, breast implants, when we look at them, you can't really see through them, but they tend to be this clear silicone that you can almost see through. But when you look at them on an x-ray or see them in a mammogram, they look very white and you can't see through them much at all. So they can pose some minor issues for people when they're having breast surveillance in the future. And people that have implants should tell the x-ray technologist that they have them, and they might take a few extra views to make sure that they can see all the breast tissue that they need to see in order to get a good study. You know, there are also some problems with scarring that can happen because of procedures that are done on the breast itself that may cause some changes that the radiologist is usually able to sort out without difficulty. But it's always good to tell the technologist you've had it. They're going to figure it out when they look at the x-ray anyway.
Right.
You know, we talked a little bit about the capsular contracture problem that happens or even the implant rupture problem that happens. Mm-hmm. I think continued surveillance and checkups and so on, you know, after you've had a surgery like a breast augmentation is always a good idea, just to have somebody have a watchful eye over that kind of issue.
Yeah.
Occasionally, people can have some problems with nipple sensation even after breast augmentation. Mm-hmm. It's usually felt that the nerve that goes to the nipple and areola area gets stretched a little bit in the procedure and can cause some changes. A lot of those go away over time. And breast reduction is probably another procedure that can have a similar outcome. The majority of people retain sensation, but there can be issues with loss of sensation.
In some areas.
In some areas, yes.
And what about breastfeeding after any of these procedures?
For breast lift surgery and breast augmentation surgery, the majority of that procedure is done in a way that the nipple and areola, which are connected to the breast to provide the outlet for the milk that's produced by the mother, usually are not disturbed. So those situations, nursing should work reasonably normally. Breast reduction surgery can be a little trickier because you're actually removing part of the breast itself. And of course, the function of the breast really is to produce the milk that the mother is going to use to nurse her child. So to the degree that there's enough breast tissue left attached to the nipple and areola following a reduction, the nursing procedure should work reasonably well. And most people do okay with it. Mm-hmm. There are some situations and times when that doesn't work as great, or maybe the amount of milk that is produced and can get to the baby isn't quite as much as would make them happy.
Right, so. Right. Makes sense. Are there any patient stories you can relate to the listeners about how important their breast rejuvenation was to them or how it may have changed their life?
Oh my gosh. You know, the good news is that happens pretty frequently.
Yeah.
You know, the decision to do a procedure like this, obviously people should consider it. You know, they should think two or three times about it before they really make a choice to do it and get as much information as they can. But quite frankly, the majority of people who do the operation, and especially if you have a nice discussion with the patient beforehand about what the realistic expectations and results can be and what the outcome, what things are going to be like, most people are pretty darn happy about it.
Yeah.
And it does change their life. Almost every one of those procedures can have that effect, and it's super gratifying for that to happen. And it makes doing it all the better.
Yeah, makes it worth it. Well, I think that's a great place to leave it here. We've talked a lot about some really wonderful procedures that can be done to rejuvenate the breast for all sorts of reasons. Thank you for taking the time to share your thoughts with us.
Thanks a lot for having me.
You bet. Well, that's our show for today. Hope you enjoyed it and learned something too. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. Please share this podcast with someone else who might be interested. And while you're at it, check out the podcast website for related topics to explore. It's www.plasticsurgerydecoded.com. And as always, thank you for listening to Plastic Surgery Decoded.